Hi everyone, Rob here. Welcome to our Blake 7 podcast, which we're calling the Blake Easy. We've had to split it into two parts. It's basically coming in at just a snidge under 3 hours long, which I personally think is maybe just a little too much for even the most rabid of Blake 7 fans. So this is part one, in which we talk about the characters, the costumes, and just generally muck around a little bit. Hope you enjoy it. I'll see you at the end of part one. For now, enjoy.
Teleporting now.
Down and safe. And welcome.
Welcome indeed to Excuses and Half-Truths presents the Blake Easy.
Yes, Rob and Clive Speakeasy, the special On the Buses episode, Blakey 7, where we talk about all seven episodes of On the Buses and... Oh, it's Blake 7.
Blake 7, you
fool. Oh, you mean I watched all seven series of that rubbish for nothing?
And the movies, I bet, as well.
Mutiny on the Buses.
Mutiny on the Buses, Holiday on the Buses, you name it.
Yes, I just, of course, we are talking about the classic BBC sci-fi series created by Terry Nation. It ran for four series on BBC One from 1978 to 1971. And joining us in here in our Space City studio.
Indeed. Welcome to Freedom City. You may notice slightly more echo than usual. That's all right. It's more science fiction-y to echo.
That's right. We're in a different space, aren't we? We have teleported into a neutral zone.
So let's introduce our guests before they knot themselves completely into Knot's corpsing. Welcome back to Mr. Keith Isles.
Oh, well, thank you. And I'm amazed that you've invited me back after me insulting you on the last podcast, the Doctor Who one. But yes, thank you. Good to be here. I guess if we've teleported to another location, we should be in a quarry pit somewhere in Cornwall, shouldn't we?
I think
we'll be that's the general idea. You're going to add in the Atmos afterwards, right?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
It's going to be fine. It's partly your fault, really, isn't it, Keith? Because you mentioned Blake 7 a lot during the Doctor Who podcast and how you were such a big fan of Blake 7. So that was part of our inspiration. Yeah. Wow. But it's not just, we're not just lucky enough to be joined by Keith. We also have a brand new guest on the podcast, author and writer on architecture and visual culture at chrismrogers.net. It's Chris Rogers. Welcome, Chris.
Ooh. Welcome, Clive. Rob.
Greetings.
Hey, thank you very much.
Long time fan and friend of the blog, so it's really good to have you here in live and in person.
Thank you. I was thrilled and delighted to be asked. And I was musing as we were getting ready on how extraordinarily better technologically equipped this space in which we're recording is than almost anything we saw in Blake 7. But, that will no doubt be touched on later. But no, thank you. I'm delighted to be on.
Fantastic. So let's make a start by, I guess, make a start by just doing a quick roundtable on how we came to be watching Blake 7 in the first place. I mean, apart from the fact that we've all, well, some of us have watched every single episode in the run-up to this particular podcast.
Deep background research.
Deep background research. Almost too deep. There are pages and pages of notes strewn around Space City here.
Not by me.
Not by me either. So you may notice a slight...
That narrows it down then, really, doesn't it?
It does. a slight imbalance in the factual observations going on. But we'll take that as read. Me first, because... I remember Blake 7 very well because I was a kid when it first came out. It was a part of the Star Wars generation, although, as we'll mention later in the show, Blake 7 wasn't quite shown at the same time as Star Wars, but certainly I was at that age where anything science fiction was just a major draw for me. So for me, Blake 7 was just one of those shows that was an absolute must. Watched it, loved it back then, and it's been a real pleasure for me to rediscover the show many, many years afterwards. Clive?
I'm a wee bit younger than you, Rob. So I remember just the last series of Blake 7. And it was kind of past my bedtime, so it was like Forbidden Fruit. There were those kind of shows which are kind of like The Professionals, like The Sweeney, where, you know, it's kind of like the exciting, kind of slightly violent shows that are on just about watershed time. And then, you know, so often I think my first exposure to Lake Seven was probably just listening to the theme tune and going, oh man, that looks really cool. And then it's be like, off you go to bed.
that's really mean. Yeah, giving you that little tease.
Well, that's the sort of gateway drug, isn't it? Really. Yeah.
That used to happen to me with Hill Street Blues, actually, but that's another story.
So, a whole nother podcast.
There indeed. You go. But I was allowed occasionally, like on, you know, bank holidays or whatever, to sort of to watch the odd episode. So I couldn't tell you which ones I watched, but it was definitely season 4. Avon was the captain. Was slightly confused why it was called Blake Seven, but you know,
as were a lot of people around that time, I'm sure.
But you know, but Avon was cool, and you know, I remember enjoying it and being a bit annoyed that I couldn't watch all of it. But there we go. And then latterly, I watched the first episode, The Way Back, as part of my sort of explorations into, you know, cult sci-fi TV and stuff like that. And then most recently, I've just watched for the first time all 52 episodes in order.
Nerd alert!
Yay!
The madness.
So, and
the horror.
And I enjoyed the hell out of that.
Crazy fool. Well, Chris?
Yeah, interestingly, I had a similar kind of restricted stroke tempted fruit experience to Clive. Although I'm old enough, as with Rob, to have seen it the first time around, and did see it the first time around in bits. The reason it was in bits is because, cue sad music, we only had one TV at home and it stayed in the front room, and Mum and Dad wouldn't have watched it and wouldn't have let me watch it as well. So I'm pretty sure that I must have sneaked the odd episode from time to time, which is why watching it again, as I've mentioned, I didn't remember 90% of it, but I definitely remember certain bits of it. And tedious family insert point here. When Charles and Di got married in 81, we got our colour telly, our first colour telly, and that meant the old black and white one could go upstairs, and that meant I could watch more stuff that I wanted to watch. So all my memories of Blake Seven, like most things, were black and white then, because that was when I watched most of the stuff. So I had these sort of fragmented memories, and that's why it was so fun, you know, other things aside, watching them all on the catch-up again, because there were literally little slices that I remembered. A couple of episodes, maybe. And as Clive said, picking it up on the fourth season, I remember the final episode, like, absolutely clearly the first time it was shown, because that was such a big deal at the time. I think one of the things you forget nowadays is, you know, even as recently as the 90s, let alone the early 80s, you didn't have the internet, you didn't have catch-up services, you just had three channels, you know, four from 82, and that was it. And so these things really were a big deal. So I remember the final episode of Blake Seven really clearly. I watched it the first time around in colour. You'll be pleased to hear. Exaggerating the blood effect perfectly. And it was really shocking. And actually, it's quite shocking now, even. I know we're jumping ahead slightly. But yeah, so I mean, that was how I got into it. And I was quite seriously into it, despite that kind of sliced approach. You know, I went on a school journey down to Wookiee Hole, down in Somerset, where they shot bits of Blake Seven. And it was quite fun seeing that on the screen again. I made a Blake Seven gun, the proper Liberator guns, not the rubbishy season 3 and 4 ones, for which my dad managed to source, in that mysterious dad way that only dads can do, a curly cord to actually connect it to the belt pack, which I thought was way cool. And I made a bracelet, the teleport bracelet, the Liberator teleport bracelet, following the instructions on Blue Peter, which was one of their famous makes, which was terrific. So yeah, those are my insights into how I got into it.
Yeah, well, mine was probably quite similar to Clive, actually. The first season I actually remember watching, sadly now in retrospect, was the fourth season. And I have sort of early memories, like I seem to remember from when it was shown, you know, the end of season 3 with the Liberator blowing up for the second time. And Avon smiling, and I seem to remember saying something to my mum about that lady's got short hair, referring to Servalan. But yeah, it was really season 4. I can definitely remember, I used to play Blake Seven in the schoolyard and stuff, and indeed
that's a real sign of cultural ingraining.
There you go. And definitely made a prop bracelet and stuff as well. Did all that stuff. But when I really got into it, actually, was about a decade later in the sort of late 80s. BBC started releasing VHS. God, that makes me feel ancient. But VHS movie edits, which was a really vogue thing to do at the time with science fiction television series. And essentially what they did was they released five 90-minute cassettes, which were edits of the first three seasons. And what they actually did was they took the serialized format and sort of got rid of the episodic pieces, and they sort of joined them together. So, the first tape dealt with the actual, the backstory and them escaping from the London and finding the Liberator. And all of that sort of thing. The second tape dealt with the Travis arc that ran through the first season and whatever. And then there was, I think the third one was called Aurak, which obviously dealt with that story. And then the final one dealt with some, it was called Aftermath, and it dealt with season three after they sort of abandoned the Liberator and obviously found their way, or Avon found his way back to it. So I very much remember enjoying them as they were, because again, the point you made, Chris, about at the time nothing else was readily available, and I remember when it first came out, I was really into Empire Strikes Back and Battlestar Galactica and stuff like that. Sort of really got into the fourth season, and then a few years later, when I was a bit older, was happy to watch these things on VHS and enjoy them that way. And then I seem to remember a kid up the road who was a little bit more spoiled or whatever. He got in sort of the early 90s, that they did on VHS release all 52 episodes. And I remember he used to let me borrow or let me go around and watch the tapes. So saw the sort of full four seasons that way. And then I think it was in the sort of 2003 or 2004, they started releasing them on DVD.
And I think the shelf space, you say.
Yeah, well, I did invest in the first season only on DVD, and which was great because they had commentaries on a few of the episodes, which I watched, and they did indeed have that retrospective Blue Peter episode that you mentioned. Nice. Where they showed you how to make one of the Liberator bracelets.
But, out of a then well-known orange squash manufacturer's bottle. Because it had just the right ribbing to it.
Yeah.
I remember.
You could make a bracelet with part of it, and then the end of the, or sort of the housing for the weapon from the other bit.
I think at this point we should issue a general spoiler warning. For all four seasons of Blake 7, we're going to spoil the hell out of this because you can't talk about Blake 7 really without talking about the season end cliffhangers, the resolution of that, what happens to certain characters, their fates.
Certain vehicles as well, perhaps?
Certain non-human characters and vehicles. And also... and how the whole thing ends up, which is part of why I think people still talk about Blake 7 now, is that final episode happens.
That definitely is what makes it a much more special sort of programme than a lot of the other sort of science fiction that the BBC was doing around then. Astonishing ending. But let's move on and talk about Blake 7, the characters themselves.
Who are the Blake 7?
Does the title even make sense?
Well, as time goes on, of course, that title makes increasingly less and less sense as Blake himself, Roger Blake, really is only in the first two seasons. He sort of appears briefly through season three and certainly in season four for a very important fraction, but... the leader of this band of ragtag revolutionaries is only really in the first couple of seasons.
And it's also, I think, interesting how one thing that struck me watching them all again in chronological order is quite how leisurely the pace of it is in building up at least the human members of the initial seven. If you watch, it actually takes four whole episodes out of 13, you know, fully a third of the series, to actually get all seven of them together. Mm-hmm. That is quite remarkable. And I think clearly wouldn't be done that way today, when in fact the biggest thing that writers struggle with in these kinds of ensemble shows is carving out definable personalities right at the beginning in the first episode. And all the TV reviewers always say the same thing, it's really hard in the first episode to get all that done. They don't do that here, and I think I was really struck by that. So
they do definitely.
You mentioned Blake, and we meet, I think, is it Villa first as well, and Jenna?
Villa and Jenna. And we don't meet anyone until two.
Yeah, and we don't meet Gan, I think, until about three or four.
No, the way it goes is obviously we meet in episode one. We just meet Blake. We have his arc. Then at the very end of that episode, we meet.
Yes, you're right.
We meet Villa and Jenna, and then in the next episode we meet Gan and Avon, and then we meet Zen
and Callie.
And Callie, yes. And Callie is even further on than that. So
And Aurak not till the end of the series, right?
Yeah,
the end of
and
the
you
season,
can argue so. That that's not proper Aurak, but we'll get into that, won't we?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think a really noteworthy point about this at this stage, particularly what you were saying, Chris, about comparing to today's television shows. I think one of the things that set Blake 7 apart was the fact that, compared to a lot of television shows at the time, it was dealing very much with, you know, obviously a bunch of anti-heroes, characters with, you know, sort of somewhat ambiguous moralistic values. You know, were they necessarily good guys? Were they necessarily people that we like? You know, nowadays with shows like, you know, it's finished now, but with shows like Lost and whatever, you know, that thing's quite normal. But I think back in the day, you know, particularly with its comparisons to Star Wars, which obviously always had a very good...
Black and white.
Yeah, exactly. Good and evil, good versus evil and all this sort of thing. This was almost like sort of Star Trek, but flipped on its head, really,
well,
where the Federation...
The Terror Federation is evil in this, isn't it? Mm. Evil, corrupt, totalitarian... You know, controlling regime.
Yeah, though, interesting. But characters like Avon, you know, they're to a penny today, that type of character. But I think maybe it's just because I was a kid or whatever, and might be naivety, but I don't know. I think that maybe at the time, that sort of character was something that audiences may have not been used to on television, at least.
It's interesting.
You'd agree with that.
We may get onto it later, and we certainly will about the Star Wars influences and references, but. It's not the only thing they flip in Blake 7 as well, because although you have Servalan, obviously, as the main Federation bad girl, she wears white as often as she wears black, unlike Darth Vader, say. And the Federation troopers, which was a really powerful, quite an iconic image, actually, at the time, I remember when I watched it, because you hardly ever see their faces, and it is a really good bit of costume design. They do wear traditional black, whereas, of course, the Star Wars Stormtroopers wore white. So it's quite interesting, those kinds of dualities. I think Keith's point is a good one, and I do understand that. I think it might be worth asking to what extent that moral ambiguity is actually carried through, either across all the characters or through the depths of the four seasons, because I don't think it necessarily is carried through. I think, yes, you do get to see how fanatical Blake becomes. Avon, I think, I say clearly, I'm biased, but I think he's clearly the most interesting character, and he does have a story arc of his own. But I'm not necessarily sure that it carries on with some of the other characters, like Jenna and Callie and Villa.
Well,
maybe.
Villa especially is pretty much one note all the way through.
I mean, so.
He's supposed to be kind of comic relief,
yeah.
I think.
And that's fine.
Yes, I suggest that there are some kind of arc changes with all the characters, but some get served more than others, and also it's that thing of with the first season, it's every single episode is written by Terry Nation, so you have a real consistency of vision. Mm. Even though Chris Boucher is the script editor for the whole four seasons, because you get all these different writers coming in, some of them are obviously more familiar with the characters than others. So you start to get a bit of inconsistency, and some are clearly, you know, more interested in some characters than others. So there were obviously like certain things which just worked, where they're like, oh, go on, I'll do more of that. Like the Villa Avon sort of double act that is really kind of, you know, one of the most consistent things about all four seasons is that relationship of the sort of Avon just being sarcastically putting down Villa at every opportunity, but at some moments actually defending him against bullying by Tarrant and other
absolutely
characters.
I think, to be fair, that does come over really well. One of the few good things about the last series is that, because there are moments where, albeit there is also a moment where Aurak reminds Avon that Villa weighs exactly the amount they need to get rid of from the spaceship at one point. But you're right, he does defend him. And I think also it shows quite how good both the writing and the performing of Avon is, because your point is obviously right around Chris Boucher providing a degree of continuity over and above the different writers. But I think a lot of that has got to be in Paul Darrow's playing of Avon, because even within, you know, it is very much of its time, there is, it has to be admitted, a degree of staginess to the whole thing, as there was with a lot of sci-fi, particularly BBC sci-fi at the time, which comes out of the British theatrical tradition. It comes out of the idea of filmed plays. It comes out of, I think it has to be admitted, a certain snobbery towards sci-fi. But even above all of that, Paul Darrow really rises above that, and it's an absolutely brilliant performance. Mm. And I think he's completely captivating throughout the whole thing. And I think purely from a character point of view and from an acting point of view, there isn't a lot to write home about, I think, across all four seasons, but that is the obvious standout, and I just think he's terrific. I mean, he's obviously one of the most strikingly cynical and self-serving characters you ever see in a mainstream drama, but he is fully realised, and as Clive said, there are other elements to him, and there's a terrific part in one of the episodes, Horizon, where there's a kind of Faustian temptation scene, but it's Avon tempting himself, talking to Zen about what he can do with the Liberator if the others are off it, and how far they can get, and how long it would take for someone to come and find him. And he's playing that out almost as like a monologue with himself. Will I do it? Will I not? And it's terrific. And it's, you know, it really is the sort of strength of the series.
It's interesting as well, the way that Avon always has this sort of self-serving thing about him, but he does still have the loyalty, not just to the group, but to Blake especially. He'll go back at the end of season three, specifically to try and rescue Blake. And there's always that kind of, we're talking about the double act between Villa and Avon, but there's also that sort of meshing between Blake and Avon as well. The fact they are kind of intertwined in ways that maybe they don't even understand themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're slightly jumping ahead. If for people who are listening who are less familiar with Blake Seven than obviously a lot of us are, having just either steeped ourselves in all 52 episodes, or
you mean not everyone's done that? I'm astonished. People listening at home are not doing that.
Well, clearly it's on their to-do list.
But, at the top.
Okay, so who are the initial
are the seven?
Crew of Blake Seven?
Who we are have Blake Seven?
Rog Blake is the leader of our gang of rebels. I mean, initially at least, the show follows Blake and this kind of motley crew of rebels against the Terran Federation as they attempt to escape from and then engage in a kind of guerrilla warfare against this, you know, monolithic kind of human totalitarian empire.
Yeah, I mean, it was always intended to be like the Dirty Dozen in space, only with six of them instead of
or Robin Hood in space.
The dirty half dozen in space.
Definitely. Yes.
Plus one.
Wow. I think Terran Nation even pitched it as that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So you definitely get that. So obviously, initially at least, Blake is this kind of slightly goody-two-shoes kind of Robin Hood character who is the sort of the pure one, the one with the vision about how they're going to take down the Federation. But that very much changes as we go through.
But he also had a rather dark backstory.
I was just about to say,
which I was a little bit shocked about.
It's
when
pretty,
I rewatched
it's pretty dark. But then What are you talking about, the Federation's smear against him?
Yes, slightly.
Do you want to share that with?
Well, he actually gets accused of being a paedophile, doesn't he?
Well,
is that right?
he gets convicted in a show trial of being a child molester.
Yeah,
I must have missed that.
It's one of those details that you're like, whoa, that's harsh.
Well, certainly in today's news, that's kind of hard. But yeah, it was quite surprising. But
we should emphasise that he's entirely innocent.
Oh, he is.
But Blake, in the first episode, the way back, which if you're starting to watch Blake 7, is a really uncharacteristic episode. It's one of those pilot episodes which is almost nothing like what the rest of the series is going to be. Mm. So you get this very, very dark dystopian vision of the future, and you get Rog Blake, who's been brainwashed. It's basically kind of like after 1984. He's been brainwashed to be this perfect citizen.
Orwellian, isn't it?
Yeah, yes. But they've mentally kind of tortured him so that he's given up all his kind of rebellion contacts, and it's about him kind of sort of coming back to realization of himself. And we also get introduced to all these other characters, some of whom are rebels, some of whom are kind of just questioning the system. And it's a nice setup, because obviously it's called Blake 7, so we'll, if you're watching it as the first time, you're thinking, oh, perhaps some of these people will be the Seven.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, interestingly, there's a character called Dev Tarrant in the first episode. It had nothing to do with the later Del Tarrant, who comes in season 3. But
and I think, picking up Clive's point, I mentioned earlier about this leisurely build-up, and it does work quite well, although clearly if you're coming to it, you know, the second or third time, the spoiler is slightly there. But it's quite a neat idea that after that initial episode that Clive mentioned, they do all meet on a prison shuttle. A slightly charmingly realised prison shuttle, it has to be said.
Yeah, the Federation decide that it's too dangerous to have Blake running around. He's too much of a figurehead for the rebellion. So they basically ship him off to the intergalactic equivalent of the colonies, like a horrible, dank prison planet which no one ever comes back from.
Although in the case of Blake, they never actually reach it, of course. And that's where we meet some of the other Seven, including Jenna Stannis, who is purportedly a smuggler and kind of independent spacewoman.
Yeah, literally a hot pilot.
Indeed. And I'm so glad that you mentioned that, almost as though you read my mind. So actually, maybe you are Callie after all. But what's interesting is, I think, despite the fact that, and obviously these things are entirely personal, and I caveat this with the usual observations around sexism, which one obviously totally abhors. But despite the fact that, as played by Sally Nivette, she is absolutely gorgeous, there seems to be almost zero sexual tension throughout the entire programmes.
I'm not sure I agree that.
Well,
she was definitely there as the space totty.
There are some things later, and again, kind of standard by 8, spoiler alert, Avon and another female character do get into a couple of clinches, which is where it perhaps goes a little bit strange. But
more than one female character.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But one of the things that I felt watching them all again is that, unlike today, and you absolutely know that if this was created and written today, not only would the characters all be 10 years younger, it would be the proverbial hotbed of sexual tension. But I just didn't feel that at all. And quite interestingly, the obvious pairing in both senses of Blake and Jenna is very much a kind of brother and sister type thing. And as they get onto their various journeys, mostly they're waved off by Jenna with a very kind of jolly hockey sticks, good luck, like that all the time. And I'm not saying they missed the trick. I just think it's strange, even and perhaps especially for those times, because there are some fairly sexist attitudes displayed later in casting and the relationships with some of the characters, particularly the fact that most of the episodes have a strong male lead and lots of, as you say, totty in varying different forms and life forms and costumes. I think it's odd that there just isn't as much of that kind of sexual repartee that you might expect.
I really disagree that
Excellent.
There isn't sexual
Bring
tension.
Bring it on.
No, I mean, I, here's the thing. I think because you don't get what you would get in shows nowadays, which is people clearly coupling up, having sexual relationships, having falling in love. I think it's partly that the show wanted to avoid that kind of subconsciously avoid that soap opera melodrama, but because it doesn't say it, I think it really encourages kind of that fan thing of shipping, of saying, oh, those characters are clearly doing it like off screen when we're not seeing them. I think you.
This is a new term you're introducing me to. I have to.
I mean,
admit
you're
it
not
in front of
this.
Millions of people.
It's that thing of it's partly sort of fan wish fulfillment of like, oh, wouldn't it be great if these two characters got together and did it?
Yeah.
And then it's partly X-Files. That sort of like, oh, well, you can clearly see in the subtext that these two characters are an item. So, and Blake and Jenna, I think Jenna's clearly affectionate towards Blake, but he's completely oblivious to it. It's all about the mission.
If I remember right, Jenna gets, she makes a somewhat bitchy comment when Callie joins them. She gets a little bit jealous, doesn't she? And
well,
makes some
she also
sort of,
has a bit of a fit of pique when Blake snogs his cousin Inga. I don't know if you remember that episode. But there are these little bits of kind of sort of things that kind of sort of stick out, you know. I mean, the other sort of one that gets the people...
Sexual reference there, but carry on.
Yeah.
Steady.
Subliminal. Avon Kelly is the other one that people say is, were they together?
Or Avon Servalan.
Definitely.
Well, that's probably the one that most people would
possibly taken a bit too far.
There's a clinch,
but our viewers might not know who Servalan is actually.
We haven't got that far
she's
yet.
She's not one
we
of the
even
seven.
Finished the seven.
She's not one of the seven. No. Okay.
So yeah, we'll get to Servalan. She deserves her own spotlight.
Series possibly.
Yeah,
cool.
Absolutely.
So yeah, let's just agree to disagree on the sex.
That's fine.
I think
that's fine.
We have got up to Jenna, Jenna Stannis, and now in the same episode we also meet Villa Restall, who's the only one of the seven who appears in all 52 episodes.
Yeah, goodness,
the only one. Played by Michael Keating. He's a skilled thief, lockpicker, and conjurer, and a massive coward with a weakness for alcohol and women.
Mm.
My kind of
I do like one of Jenna's comments in, I think it might be the second or third episode, when they're trying to find a volunteer to go into this really cramped bit of the ship that fills up with shaving foam, and
special sealant.
Oh, sealant, yes. Yeah, and he says, "I've got this thing about this condition about confined spaces. It begins with C," and she goes, "Cowardice." I just think that was. Always quite a good, snappy retort. Yes.
Yes, it must be said that Terry Nation is very good on the sort of sarky comments, isn't he? That's part of his writing style, and it informs all the characters, and it's picked up by the other writers as well, isn't it?
It's kind of interesting the way that the notion of the seven kind of being forced together is very much referenced in this writing, the fact that they're constantly bitching and sniping and moaning at each other.
But then, conflicts,
Well, yeah,
the wellspring of drama, as they say. So we've got Villa, and we've got, and then in the following episode, we meet up with Kerr Avon. We've already gone into how great Paul Darrow is.
His reputation precedes him even in this podcast.
Yeah.
He's an electronics and computer expert, and they give him this kind of personal code based on sort of logic and reason, and a slightly unflattering haircut. He's deeply cynical, and he frequently clashes with Blake, and that's kind of like the thing that defines him, at least initially.
Well, he's kind of the yin of Blake's yang, isn't he? He's sort of the with Blake's the optimist, he's the cynic.
And if Blake's the idealist, then he's perhaps the realist as
yes,
well.
Yes, yeah.
Although interestingly, we haven't mentioned his backstory, which is that he is on the prison shuttle because he, and this is the important bit, failed, though planned to, execute a massive heist to rip off the Federation's equivalent of Fort Knox. And I think that's actually quite interesting, because throughout all four series and towards the end, when, as Rob mentioned earlier, Blake is not actually in it, Avon becomes the de facto leader, albeit still with the bitching and sniping from everyone. He is often portrayed, and often portrays himself, as right most of the time, and often makes those kinds of comments, and others have them made about him as well. And yet he actually failed in his biggest attempt at his biggest thing. So that's actually quite interesting in itself.
And definitely through the first season, you know, the pursuit of wealth and power is still his sort of primary objective, which obviously is a little bit different to Blake's agenda.
Yes.
But for most.
But then we get more backstory with him later, particularly in beginning of season three, when it becomes the, you know, well, Avon's five.
I guess Avon's five and 5.2. Or...
Yeah. Yeah, so let's round out the crew, shall we? Oleg Gann, played by David Jackson.
This is where you should
the
say...
The muscle.
Who? Because a bit like John Deacon in Queen, he was the last one to join and the first one to leave.
Oh, no, not the last one to join. He joined...
No, that's true.
I think you... Yeah.
I should say he was apparently the least popular, which turned out to have rather...
He was like the sort of Little John character.
Pretty much, if we're going for that.
That's a fair point.
He was the muscle. I mean, it was the typical thing. Every one of them had, even though they didn't necessarily get on with one another, they all brought something to the table.
They had a role.
Even Villa, who, you know, a massive coward and all this sort of thing, was, you know, the expert.
He's like the human sonic screwdriver, isn't he? They bring him along to open every door.
He was obviously so good that, as you pointed out, he wasn't good enough to escape the whole series, though, because he was, as you say, in every episode. Yeah. But interestingly, Gann and Villa are together when we meet them, in the sense that one is the kind of protector of the other.
Mm. That's true.
And I think, although it's not said, I think it's reasonably implied that, unlike Little John, Gann isn't portrayed as unintelligent, but you could read it that he is the brawn to Villa's brain.
Yeah, he's the gentle giant.
Mm. Yeah, very much so. Quite deliberately a gentle giant. He's actually got a chip in his head that stops him from being too violent.
Yeah.
Which, in some ways, limits his usefulness in that he can't really get involved particularly in fights.
At least until there's some brain surgery, after which it's a bit woolly as to whether, you know, the Eliminator is still working, you know, because he does seem to sort of, well, you know, swat more guards after that.
But it seems to be also one of those things that kind of sounds like a good idea from the scripting point of view at the time, but then you realise it's actually limiting the scripts also.
Yeah, exactly.
There's not much you can do with a large man who makes sage interjections, so you do need to do something about that.
Yeah. David Jackson's cited that as one of the main reasons that he left the show in the first place. He was just sick of not really having anything do.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, so as Robert said, after killing the Federation guard who murdered his girlfriend, he gets this implant put in. That's basically his backstory. Next, we meet up with Callie, played by Jan Chappell.
Who's the only alien.
That's
character.
Right.
Conveniently human.
Yeah, not in the bug-eyed alien sense. Yeah. She's just a non-Terran human, although she's a guerrilla fighter from the planet Auron. One of a race of telepaths.
Although the telepathy is quite interestingly, I was going to say defined, but I think that's maybe going too far. It seemed, slightly amusingly, to be quite hard to read how they were defining the telepathy. It seems there's the usual clunky explanation where she explains that she can't just read anyone's mind, but she can project thoughts into their mind. It's a useful one, and it
becomes a plot device in several episodes.
Several, but not many, interestingly. Mm. It's not as though it's, and maybe this is a benefit, actually, and a good thing, that it's not overused. It just seems to be there handily if you need it, like a sort of mental Swiss Army knife.
Yeah, unfortunately, Callie becomes a bit of a kind of victim of like a running sort of gag, I guess you could say, with the show, which is that... As a telepath, she's kind of uniquely vulnerable to mind control by aliens.
Yeah.
So we get not one, not two, but like several episodes in which Callie is either possessed or taken over, or it's somehow influenced by outside forces.
Although that, from memory, at least one of those did give rise to some quite interesting scenes and some quite interesting.
Oh yeah, no, I'm quite not, interesting. Not, some of those episodes I like. It's just the fact that it keeps happening. You know, you might. I did think after a couple of them that maybe they might put her off, you know, at a nearby planet where they, because she's a security risk. but no, Callie's great, and also she kind of develops, especially after Gan goes, because Gan is one of his roles was the kind of sort of conscience of the group, I guess you say. Because he had like
I was
going to
say that it's very much so.
But when he goes, then Callie sort of takes over that mantle as the sort of moral conscience, and she was always someone who could kind of you know, have a go at Avon or Blake.
Yeah, she's got quite a, again, as played by Jan Tripel, as you say, she has quite a cool kind of detached demeanour, which actually works quite well. And you could say there's a link there with perhaps Maya from Space 1999.
I was thinking exactly that, you know, the cool alien telepath.
But since we don't have the ITC budget, obviously without the shape-shifting.
Yeah.
So that's six.
Six including Blake, which is always weird.
Yeah,
because it's
Blake's
seven
brackets, including Brent. Yeah.
including Blake.
It's not quite like Blake, Blake and his hot seven.
No, but there's no apostrophe.
I was going to say, a properly punctuated title would have to be Blake apostrophe seven brackets, including Blake.
Yeah, the seventh character is actually non-human. It's Zen, the main ship's computer of the Liberator, which is this strange, mysterious craft which... the crew end up, well, they find, basically.
Well, you say...
Sorry.
Keith, go on.
No, I was going to say, I kind of wanted to hang on the Liberator
just for
a minute, if you don't mind. Definitely. Just because one of the things, I think this is one of the show's strengths, okay? The show is renowned for sort of having wobbly sets and spaceships on strings and, you know, on fishing wire and all those sort of things. However, from a design point of view... I always thought the Liberator, both exterior and interior, as this mysterious alien ship, was, really, really well conceived. And the other thing about the Liberator, unlike in Star Trek, the Enterprise or whatever, is the Liberator is also something that gives Blake Seven, you know, or the crew, the edge, because it is a faster, more powerful ship than any other ship in the galaxy or whatever. Plus, they have the teleportation system, which is not a common thing across the Federation or anything.
It's made
like
very clear
that
it's been experimented with, but it's never been made to work.
Yeah, yeah.
It slightly sort of evens the odds, because obviously, you know, if it's just a very small band against this massive Federation, which has got all these, you know, infinite resources, essentially... then it just becomes a matter of when are they going to die, you know, if it's like that. But this just, it's slightly kind of, it gives you two things. One, it sort of slightly evens the odds. And two, it gives Servalan a reason to go after the Blake, to go after him because she wants the ship.
Even when Blake's gone.
Because it's got advanced.
That's made very clear.
Yeah, it's got advanced technology that it can repair itself.
It's
got all these sort of things. And one could argue, actually, that the Seventh is kind of the Liberator as well. Although Zen
is definitely on Callie's wavelength, because I would agree with that 100%. And I was going to say exactly the same thing, because I would actually say that it isn't Zen is the Seventh. The Seventh is the Liberator. Zen is just the Liberator's voice, and I think that is actually quite explicit in the early episodes. I completely agree with what Keith said, and I think, you know, in modern military terminology, the Liberator would be a force multiplier. It allows you to do something more than you might otherwise lead your numbers to suggest. And I think the way it's introduced is actually as interesting, possibly even more interesting, than a lot of the other characters. Picking up, as was referenced earlier, the way the first few episodes run, where most of the Seven are on a prison ship, they take over the ship and they escape and they encounter the Liberator. And I think the conceit of the Liberator as a found object of unknown origin, as Keith said, as we later find out, designed by a humanoid alien civilization that we don't know anything about at this stage, comes over brilliantly. It's particularly interesting that in one of the few strengths in terms of special effects sequences, when we see the crew exploring the Liberator, we don't get to see it until they get to see it. And I think that's really interesting from a directorial point of view. I think I have to say, and I was quite surprised at this, although maybe I shouldn't have been, directorially and in a lot of other ways, technically, it's quite weak as a series, unfortunately. There are touches, but mostly it's quite...
I think that depends. It depends on which director you're talking about.
That's interesting. I would pick out
one in particular as being very strong. Okay. But generally, maybe it's, you know, it's kind of its time.
Yeah. But I think that sequence where they go through an umbilical cord, which again is actually quite well realised because it's made physically in the same way it actually is shown on the screen as this kind of enclosed tube that it moves. You see them exploring the ship. It's designed differently than the Federation ships. The flight deck is quite interesting and quite different. It's a humanoid crew it was originally designed for, clearly, but not human. You see them discovering the guns, which are totally unlike the clunky black guns that the Federation troops have got. They don't quite know how they work.
No, I rather like that the design trickled down into everything, yes, including the guns, because rather than what we traditionally see in sci-fi as a gun, which is obviously modelled after, you know, weapons of today and the past, these were absolutely unique.
I think what's interesting is, and we talked about the Star Wars influences, and yet this must have come first. You know, there's almost a bit of the lightsaber about it because there's a degree of elegance to these guns. And I think it's really interesting how a lot of the best sci-fi series really succeed when they generate their own internally coherent language. And it can be a visual language, it can be words, repetitive gestures, repetitive sounds. And there's quite a bit of that in Blake Seven, and it works quite well.
Yeah, they've got their own nomenclature.
Aurax switching on sound or... the way Zen introduces himself and signs off. What I think is really interesting, and it's particularly interesting that in a lot of the individual episodes, plot-wise and dialogue-wise, they are quite weak. But one of the things that is consistently good is the technological language they use, which I've always been quite a fan of, and I was thinking on the way here where that started, and it's a wider subject than we can cope with. But you could argue it started in the 80s with things like James Cameron and Aliens, where you take modern military language and you insert that into a sci-fi background. But
Star Trek kind of did it as
Maybe. But they really ran with it.
Well, Wrath
of Khan certainly is.
Yes,
you know,
and that was very specifically done like that. But it really works well in Blake Seven, and it really works because it's not just, you know, every episode when they need to talk to Zen, when they need to talk about stuff, it's like they're doing it as you would if you were using a real machine and a real thing. And going back to the characters again, I think Zen is a brilliant characterization by Peter Tudnam, who, as we know, did the voices of Aurak and the voice of Slave from the later ship as well. But I think Zen is brilliant.
I agree.
He's so well done, and he's a kind of efficient minimalist character. And he does become a true member of the Seven, but he is the voice of the Liberator as well. Mm. And I think what's really wonderful is in the last episode of Series 2, when the Liberator does get nominally destroyed, or actually destroyed, I think, he has this amazing farewell scene where, unlike Aurak, who is petulant and childish almost and like a human, Zen is just completely mechanical. And yet, in this very last episode, he says... when he's breaking down, he says, "I'm sorry, I've failed you."
Watching that again almost brought me to tears. Absolutely, I remember that at the time, and it was just like...
And
wow.
I think I kind of read it as a kind of pointed opposition to Hal in 2001, who, if you read the book and if you read the sequel, it's clear that he wasn't being evil. He was just conflicted and was programmed wrongly. But you get the feeling that he was evil, whereas with Zen, he wasn't. He never let the crew down. And that's why he was afraid that he'd failed them. And I think he's a brilliant characterisation.
And you know, like I was saying earlier about early memories from a kid, really, before you can appreciate anything, I do remember Zen being that sort of weird sort of circular, spherical brown thing with lights behind that generated the voice and whatever. And that's one of those memories. Yeah. So back to design. Sorry, Clive, you were going to say something.
A slight correction. The last appearance of Zen and the Liberator is The end of series 3.
Oh, I
episode, it's terminal, in Terminal, yeah.
Yeah, apologies, I had the wrong series, but that's, that makes more sense.
No, I'm completely on board with you as to how kind of moving that sort of, you know, it should just, you know, it's a computer character. Mm. But I think what gives Punch those sort of final words is that that's the only time that Zen ever refers to himself in the first person as an I.
Yeah, which villain
and
then,
and it completely recontextualises everything that's gone before, all the interactions with the crew. Because up to then, you just kind of, it's just like the voice of the ship's computer.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then that makes it like, oh, it is a properly kind of self-aware, self-intelligent kind of system.
Mm.
Although interestingly, in particularly when Aurek comes into it, and I'm not sure that is always a good idea, but, and I know it was commented on at the time about the idea of the two computers, if only because of the issue around how many in the crew now. they don't. I think I'm right in saying they don't actually even use the word artificial intelligence, or if they do, it's only a brief mention in relation to Aurek particularly. And certainly the idea was around then. And obviously there was a particular deliberate playing off there of the two. He's described at one point as a rational calculator, I think, Zen, which kind of goes to Clive's point that, on the face of it, that is what he is, and yet he clearly does have, there is something more there.
But again, he comes with the mystery of the Liberator.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I say mystery until they kind of give you the backstory in season two, which annoys me.
But one thing I did think was interesting, we talked quite a bit about what might have influenced Blake Seven and what was happening at the time to a degree, although we haven't touched on half of the series that were around. Flashing forward to perhaps the next in terms of chronological stylistic versions of that, a long kind of story arc of Babylon 5, I was kind of struck by the link between the people that built the Liberator and the Vorlons in Babylon 5, where you have this idea of a mysterious race where you don't really know what they do and how they function and all the rest of it. Obviously in Babylon 5 they were part of the group of different races that you saw. But the mystery was always there. And I think it was really good in Blake 7 that you did have this idea of the Liberator, as you say, Keith, until they kind of slightly unveil it a bit more. You don't know where it comes from. You don't even know what it was called. I think we might find out.
It's called Space Vehicle 2 or something like that.
The name the Liberator is something that Zen sort of apparently takes from Jenna's thoughts, which is not something they
must have missed.
Into.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, basically, they something about Zen is able to sort of
scan you
and read, what their
which
names
is interesting
were,
because actually there are, despite what I've just said about continuity of language and approach and things, of which there is a lot of it, there are a few, and it's perhaps not surprising, fandom is full of people arguing about the minutiae of series continuity. That's interesting because,
welcome,
of course, there is an important-ish bit in one episode where Servalan does get the Liberator, at least tries to, and she has to be, everyone who operates then has to be voice, he has to learn
that's
their
it.
Voice. Mm. So actually that goes against slightly the idea of the scanning idea.
Yeah.
And there's also a bit they make quite a big deal of in the first episode where they find the Liberator with the guns, because one of them tries to pull two out at once,
that's
and it burns them.
Yeah.
And it says you can't use two at once. And yet there are at least two episodes, and I'm sorry, I'm nerdy enough to have spotted this, there are at least two episodes later where they're quite freely carrying around two guns. So you can't really have a go at the script editors or the writers for that. But it is quite interesting because it's the old problem of you try and set rules, and then it's really hard then. The more rules you have, the harder it is to break them.
I agree.
Without an excuse.
And I also agree totally with your point, is there's definitely some HAL 2001 influence in there as well, I think.
Mm.
But never really thought of that until now.
Moving slightly sideways from that as well, Tim in the original version of The Tomorrow People, same kind of thing. With
gosh, yes, I'd forgotten that.
This sort of glowing globe.
That's another one of those series that I have kind of sliced memories of. Mm. So that's
interesting. Don't know them. I've only seen a few of the rebooted series, there's a reason I only saw a few of them. Anyway, sorry.
Interesting show.
Is that the Seven?
No, well, it depends where you draw in the line, doesn't it? Aurek, I guess, is the last of the sort of like the first batch of heroes, isn't it? First appears in the episode Aurek, as you might expect. season, the end of season 1, finale, episode 13. Initially voiced by Derek Farr in the first appearance only, and then subsequently, because it made more sense and because he's a very good actor, Peter Tudenham takes over voicing duties because it made, you know, it made production sense to just have one person. Yeah. One person just behind the scenery with a microphone.
The reason Aurak had that voice initially was it was the voice of his inventor. And that was in that episode.
That's right.
Later self-plagiarised by Boucher for Star Cops with Nathan Calder's little box, which speaks with his own voice as well.
Box.
Conveniently.
Okay. But, I mean, I suppose that's a slight continuity Repton, but it never seemed too distracting to me. It seemed to me
they completely changed the character, which you could argue with Travis they did. there's a recasting there as well.
We should talk about the bad guys. The heroes must have an opposition.
Let's just finish off with Aurak, and then we have to go and talk about our main two villains of the piece. What differentiates Aurak from Zen is, well, one is portable.
In the 70s sense, yes.
Yeah, in a sort of...
In the way a Hostess trolley was called.
It's kind of a Perspex fish tank.
Yes.
Filled with electronic lights and gizmos, yeah.
Yes, it's a curious choice, it has to be said.
Yeah, but mainly it's the sort of personality and abilities. He's given this sort of prissy, arrogant personality.
Civil servant type thing.
Yeah, who resents being asked to do any task that considers beneath it because it's so super intelligent. Aurak can access and take control of other computers.
Something else that gives Blake an edge, isn't it?
Yeah, and again, it's another object of value that Servalan wants.
Yes.
Speaking of who, who is this Servalan?
Servalan is a strikingly attractive, it has to be said, short, cropped-haired, elegant woman who, when
Supreme
we first
Commander,
meet her,
isn't it?
Is Supreme Commander of the Federation. Not something that's ever actually defined in any meaningful sense, but nevertheless, it does permit her to sashay around the galaxy in a succession of off-the-shoulder dresses.
Which get increasingly outre as we go
on. Indeed. Controlling her troops and her minions, and elegantly, it has to be said, sashaying across any surface known to man in high heels, including rock quarries, the aforementioned quarries. Snowdrift, sand, anything else, anything.
Where it doesn't quite work so well is when she's out off the spaceships and the so on. Pierce is great.
Rather like R2-D2 and K9, she manages to make it work along those kinds of surfaces when you wouldn't normally take high heels. She is an extraordinary character, and I mentioned earlier my sort of youthful memories of this series the first time around in these kind of impressionistic slices, and unsurprisingly, Servalan is a very strong part of that. As Clive said, she is a fantastic actress. It's an extraordinary kind of casting coup, and I, without knowing all the background about how it was done, it was hard work enough, dear readership and listenership, to watch all 52 episodes without going into the making of as well. It would be interesting to know whether it was written with her in mind or whether she came into it as a casted, you know, an auditioning actor. I don't know whether any of my colleagues around here can enlighten me.
I may have heard this wrong, but I thought the idea was initially there was an idea that Servalan was going to be played by a male actor.
Yes, really,
that's correct.
And then it was recast, so it's the kind of Ripley
exactly.
Before Ripley idea.
Which is kind of, yeah, that's really quite interesting, actually. Mm.
And interestingly enough, Servalan as a character was only really supposed to be in one episode, but she made such a strong impression immediately that character started rolling out and she became the evil heart of the entire show.
And again, I think as we pulled Arrow as Avon, as we've said, a huge amount of that rests with Jacqueline Pierce, because no matter who the script writer is and how the editing went, it was her delivery of those lines, it was the continuity of that character. I think, as with a lot of the other characters, it did get somewhat attenuated as you get through to the fourth series, and it becomes somewhat repetitive and somewhat
almost self-parodic, as I think, to be fair, some of the entire series did get. Yeah, but nevertheless,
it definitely veers into camp.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was trying to avoid that word, but I think you're absolutely right, and that's perhaps inevitable. Just as an aside, it is curious, though, that actually none of the characters keep the same clothing from episode to episode, with the possible exception of Travis, even, especially Servalan. Interestingly, even the crew of our seven change their costumes regularly in each episode, which is quite amusing. I know there was always a joke in Doctor Who about there being a room full of clothes, which you see, I think, Romana exploring at several points.
Apparently that exists on the Liberator too. They do.
So as well as the teleport room, there's also a hugely well-stocked wardrobe.
Because their first opportunity, they get out of their prison fatigues, essentially. Mm. So.
Although, interestingly enough, there's a yellow chamois outfit that Villa starts off wearing, and then Callie takes over, bizarrely enough.
Yeah, and then you see Tarrant wearing, I think, one of Avon's outfits at one point as well.
So unisex is important in the universe. Of
well, you know how it is. If they're all having sex with each other, then they just wait up. Just pull up.
Whichever's available. Yeah.
Are we going to talk about? We are going to talk about costumes at some point, right?
We might as well talk about fashion. As we're in the. I mean, some of the fashions on that show are frankly extraordinary.
Fabulous
and kinky.
I personally think that they're using ABBA's cast-offs. I think would be the only rational explanation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have to say, it's no big secret that I'm a real fan of the original series, you know, the one that Terry Nation wrote all the episodes for, etc. But I mean, that goes down as far as the things like costuming. For me, I've seen a wonderful interview actually with the lady whose name escapes me, but who took over the costuming from season two. And whereas I kind of, you know, she was trying to make the costumes reflect each of the characters in a certain way and whatever, and I sort of applaud that. But for me, you know, season two, I have issues with season two for a lot of reasons. And one of the things was that they changed things like the costuming, and I actually thought that it was all a bit more believable for me in season one.
I think to be fair,
they went very camp.
They did, and interestingly and particularly disturbingly, distressingly, certainly season the series, you'll note, incidentally, listeners, that we use those terms interchangeably because we've got it drummed into us so much that even though we're talking about a British series, we are repeatedly talking about seasons, so I do apologise as a real stickler for this.
It's A, B, C, and D correctly for
Excellent.
Blake, for we'll British
try and
Blake
that.
7.
I really?
Yeah.
I think it's particularly irritating that in those filler episodes where it's yet another planet, yet another quarry, yet another strange race that look very human conveniently.
Another primitive race of sort of cavemen type
Vikings.
With women as decoration, etc., etc. And with almost certainly Servalan somewhere in the background. And another unobtainable mineral stroke weapon stroke computer stroke nerve sensor to attack stroke destroy stroke capture. It is disappointing that a lot of the costumes of those races, if you like, they are a bit laughable, it has to be said. One of the influences that I thought was quite strong on the series was Flash Gordon, and I don't mean the Mike Hodges one, I mean the original one from the 1930s. And I think it's disappointing that not just in the design, but in the attitude, actually. You talked about the campery. There's a lot of that in the later series where you get the impression that no one is really actually taking it that seriously. And I think it's frustrating to sci-fi fans because obviously, as I said earlier, there is far less so now, but to a degree, there's always been that snobbery against sci-fi. And I think even when, as I think Clive and Keith were particularly saying, first season, second season definitely are quite hard-edged adult political stuff, you know, even despite the sci-fi trappings. And yet that's almost completely abandoned in the last series.
Yeah. Well, I remember Blake getting this sort of duck-turd green top with these ridiculously blousen arms, and it just looked absolutely ridiculous.
Blake doesn't do well. I mean, in the first season,
Why are you so serious all the time? He's trying to avoid that.
He's talking about Lumber with this lime green hoodie.
In the first season, he gets this kind of like Robin Hood style jerkin thing, which looks quite cool on him, especially compared to the sort of massive sort of sleeves. You know, he wondered if trying to give Paul Gareth, you know, a complex about his body size, because it just balloons out everywhere, you know. but I would slightly stand up for season two costuming in that I think some of season one's costumes were poor,
bland.
Yeah, well,
it's just sober.
Yeah. We're talking about the there's the prison stuff, which is obviously is drab and bland, and that's what it's supposed to be. But it's the stuff they change into on the Liberator. I mean,
didn't Avon in one of them wear like a silver spangly jersey or something?
Yeah,
Avon. To be fair, Avon does generally get the black stuff and the leather.
It's either black or silver.
It's the sort of massively kind of studded leather.
I was just about to say, yeah. He did have to. There was one episode he did have to. His teleportation down to the planet was somewhat limited by the fact that he was wearing a kind of a leather thing, but also with what looked like someone's gloves hanging off the shoulders.
Yeah, and that's the episode Death Watch. Which
is actually one of the best episodes, but he also labours with some sort of Michael Jackson-esque glittery gloves as well at some point, which is slightly disturbing. I think
he prefers the term gauntlets, but
Avon definitely would, actually. I think Paul Darrow might quite go for gloves. I think Jenna in particular sort of starts off also as this, as I say, fairly empowered for 1978 female space pirate, but then sort of degenerates into, as indeed Sally Nivette said herself, the housewife aboard the Liberator that makes the tea and sort of waves them goodbye.
I've heard the term space receptionist has been used by certain fans, and it's unfortunately sad but true. It's like some writers just didn't know what to
do. I think, to be fair, it wasn't just the female characters where that was an issue. You know, from, as I say, this quite hard-edged political series, it did kind of degenerate lately into quite an immature, quite repetitive, quite formulaic, actually quite childish sort of sci-fi adventure, which is a real shame. You know, a lot of the traits of the remaining original characters, the traits are quite exaggerated. As we've said, it gets a little bit hammy, a little bit campy. But, yeah. You know, talking of costumes, one man who was defiantly consistent in his costume is our final bad guy, which is Travis. Or both of them, the Travi, perhaps we should call them.
Space Commander Travis.
Yes, as an aside, but that's another one of those irritating sort of flaws in the writing. Space Commander, it's like talking about space aliens. It's a little bit childish and a little bit kind of irritating. But yes, introduced first as played by Stephen Greif, but actually introduced in a slightly camp shot as well, where all you see is his left arm on his hip, wearing his black one piece. It's supposed to look menacing, it just looks camp, which is slightly annoying. But yes, he is the hard guy, the hard guy's hard guy. I actually thought when I was a kid watching it, he did have some kind of eye patch, but I'm still not quite sure, having watched the episodes that they both feature in, whether that's supposed to be an eye patch, or as the script tends to suggest, it's actually burned skin, because there's a reference
to
him being
involved. Well, it depends which Travis we're talking about, doesn't it?
Okay, fair enough.
Travis 1,
Stephen Greif,
or Travis Prime, if you prefer, as this kind of Phantom of the Opera kind of half face mask sort of thing.
A quarter of his head is covered.
Yeah, I mean, he has lost an eye and an arm to Blake, and he's and they've been replaced by these prosthetics. And the arm has a concealed laser in it,
And he's absolutely whacking great.
Yeah. So if Servalan is the sort of Swarovski
crystal to fire,
exactly.
If Servalan is the sheriff of Nottingham in this kind of Robin Hood in space, then he is Guy of Gisborne.
Absolutely. He is, as played by Stephen Greif, he is flamboyant is perhaps the wrong word, but as I say, he is full blooded and he puts a lot into his performance. And as with Servalan, they do not appear. We talked about this gradual introduction.
Episode 6.
Indeed, until episode 6, which is, for those of us watching it backwards, as it were, again, it was a little thrill to see them both suddenly appear halfway through this first series. And yes, as Clive said, you do get this, leaving aside we've talked about Servalan's motivations in sort of triple motivation, Blake, Liberator, Aurak.
With Travis, it's just one motivation, which is Blake
Lay.
Revenge.
Bloody revenge. Yes.
Tiny bit obsessed.
He is, just a little bit. Not quite as doesn't deliver it with quite as much panache as Khan, perhaps, in Star Trek, Rothov. But a useful foil. I mean, it's a tough life being a revolutionary in 300 years' time, 700 years' time.
Whenever it's supposed to be set. That's never really made.
No, and it's interesting because if it is 700 years, they still have doors that look really similar to the sort of doors you get today. It's strange that. But yeah, poor old Blake had, you know, Avon stabbing him from one side and the threat of Travis from the other. But it does make for an entertaining group of episodes. But yes, we've talked about Travis 1, or Travis Prime, as Clive would have it.
And if there's any bias coming out,
replaced at some point in the not too distant future by Brian Croucher as Travis 2, or as I would say, Travis Prime, because he's absolutely brilliant. And is interesting is how they're both very different actors, and it's interesting that Croucher is now always associated with Travis rather than Greif. And they are very different actors, and their style is very different. And even as we've alluded to, their costume
is where he gets the eye patch,
which is more patch,
to the sort
say.
Of,
albeit without the string.
This is where my problem with it all really is. Right? I mean, first of all, in any fiction, you know, filmed fiction stuff, I absolutely hate it when they change actors for a character, just because, you know, it's something, I obviously from a production point of view, I completely understand why this happens and whatever, but I always hate it because for me, it takes away some of the believability and reality of it. But in the case of Travis, not only, they changed everything in so much as it had gone from, as Clive said, a sort of quarter headpiece where, okay, you could see his eye behind it or you could see the pupil of it, but you know, it covered this, to literally being like a pirate's eye patch. So they changed the, you know, obviously the costume and the prosthetic piece or whatever completely, but they also cast an actor who looked completely different in every way, apart from the fact he was a white male in his 30s or whatever. But other than that, completely different in all ways. And in terms of performance, played the character completely different. And I have to say, even though, yes, I get it, there was an element of camp with Stephen Greif's, portrayal, I kind of liked it. When it got to Brian Croucher, I mean, you know, I'm sure he's a nice enough guy. I've seen him interviewed and all this. He seems like a good egg. But, oh, my God, talk about over-the-top camp, chewing the scenery.
See, that's interesting, because I completely disagree. And I just thought he was awful.
He did eight episodes and Greif only did five, or something.
I'll go back again to my childhood memories. Weirdly, of all the things, apart from the final shot of the final episode, that I remembered was just one scene, which I remembered really clearly before I'd even watched them all for this broadcast. And it was, spoiler, Standard by 12 coming up, it was when Travis 2 kills Gan with a grenade. And it's a great scene in one of the best episodes of the whole series. And
pressure point.
I remembered that really, really clearly. And I respectfully, with my friend Mr. Isles over there, completely and utterly disagree. I think Stephen Greif was the one who chewed the scenery. He played it like you would expect a classically trained actor, given this slightly cheap and cheesy sci-fi script, would play it. Whereas Brian Croucher, apart from being, and I haven't looked it up personally, apart from being more of an East End kind of lad, or possibly South London lad.
Quite obviously with the accent.
Yeah, which I think works really well. And I think, and we'll talk about best episodes later, but I'll just put a little taster out there of one of mine. In season 2, Trial, which is one of the best episodes, when, for reasons too complex to explain here, Travis is actually put on trial, interestingly. And you really get the impression with Croucher, apart from the fact he was fortunate enough to have longer and better scripts, I think, than Greif, you really get the impression that it was his character as this it's made very clear in the series, Soldier, who's a really good commander, who's got the respect of his men, albeit through a slight reign of terror, but because he's been there and he's done that, and he makes them, as we all know, the best commanders are like that. We talked before the recording about Band of Brothers. That's how Richard Winter's got the respect of his men. With Crouch's portrayal of Travis, you really get that. And you also get in the episode Trial the idea that he is kind of struggling to articulate himself because he is actually one of the men, one of the lads, and he doesn't like all this highfalutin politics stuff. He just wants to get on and kill rebels. And I think that comes over really well with Brian Croucher, and I think that's why he is the kind of fan favourite.
Could you actually buy, though, that it was even the same character?
No, but I don't know. I don't think you have to. I take your point, and it's really interesting hearing you say that because, as I think, you know, we all know, in genre and non-genre, changing actors and keeping the characters the same happens a lot. You know, I was, along with my mum and dad, I was traumatised in Dallas when they changed, who is it? Not Miss Ellie, one of the other characters in it, I can't remember. They changed them 2 or 3 times, and it's really, really annoying. But you just have to go with it. And I think, as you alluded to, Greif wasn't in it that much. I think, as I say, I think Croucher got the better scripts. I got over that. It probably helped that my childhood memories wore off Croucher completely. So I kind of, watching it again, I kind of saw Greif as the sort of interruption to the continuity of Croucher.
I guess I'm sort of, I feel like the kind of neutral party in between these two sort of like...
lukewarm water.
Yeah,
the listeners at home, Clive forces. Actually is literally in the middle of me and Keith. So
I'm sort of holding him back from coming to blows here. But
we've agreed on everything so far, haven't we?
I think Travis Wine is interesting because he has kind of a clear strategy for dealing with Blake, and he likes to sort of set traps. You see it in Duel. You see it in he's kind of unlucky, I guess is the best way of putting it. That there are certain times
he's like Decker in the A-Team.
No, that's, you're not helping your own cause.
You know. You're not actually, because that is exactly what he's like.
If it wasn't for sort of a certain amounts of bad luck, then he would have killed Blake, you know, in the first season. I would say,
but because he didn't, you kind of got this sense of it's starting to be repetitive, and it's almost like
Wacky Races.
It's
diminishing returns, but because he's not in it that much, he's just in that sort of second half of the first season. I think that was it for me. It was wearing thin by the end of it, by Ulrich. But then when we get Travis too, it really does change, and he becomes slightly more buffoonish, I think. I think it's because he's less successful, you know. Apart from the sort of killing of Gan, you know, he gets drummed out of the Federation. He gets saddled with his terrible kind of sort of space spaghetti Western outfit in a couple of episodes. Including one of my favourites. But hey,
in some ways, I kind of dig that because he's having to make his own way and he's having to sort of bump around.
I found it really...
Yeah, exactly. He's like the kind of East End guy doesn't quite know why he's there. But
and
he's
kind of loses it completely at the end when he sort of basically gives up the Federation to the Andromedans.
I have a problem with that bit, which is like, he doesn't give up, he gives up humanity. Mm. He sells out all of humanity because
as Avon puts it, I guess I don't like crowds.
No, that's what Blake says, isn't it? When he's in character. As Travis, but it's that thing of like sort of Blake after sort of Blake sort of has an opportunity to kill him about sort of 3 times. You know, he's just sort of at one point sarcastic says you're not worth killing, and he never really recovers from that. You know, he just becomes. It becomes a bit buffoonish, and then you have to go to this leap where he sells out all of humanity to these aliens because, you know, at least Blake will die and I'll get my opportunity to kill him. It's like, that's a bit of a stretch. I appreciate them in different ways.
The Travis and I think... Travine. I think going back to that episode trial again, which comes, it's immediately the episode after he kills Gan, and but as I say, for reasons I can't remember, he does get put on trial. But it is interesting because he does get some good lines.
Well, he fails to kill Blake, that's why.
Indeed, yes.
He fails.
Actually, I think he does get some good lines. There are some really good lines in that episode. And even, you know, Travis, we haven't talked actually about the relationship between, too much about the relationship between Servalan and Travis, and it is, as Clive accurately characterised it, but also there is obviously a bit of a Emperor Kum or Grand Moff Tarkin to Vader kind of thing. Travis is the henchman who does the job. And, you know, there's a lovely bit in Trial where Servalan says that it's a shame Travis has to die, he's so much better than anything I've got left, which I think is a lovely line. But yeah, it's interesting that, you know, you can have these two different reactions to two different interpretations of the same character, which is the only time they do that in the series.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a shame. I just think it spoiled it a little for me, I have to say. But we should talk, though, as you mentioned that, about Gan and Gan dying, because a massive spoiler alert. But
we've already done. I think we covered that. If you're still listening,
he dies.
Yeah. But no. I don't know, for the time, was that something quite... Again, we're used to it with modern television series where one of the main characters could die at any time, and obviously in films. But what about, I don't know, was that somewhat of a shock in Blake's...
Well, it depends. If you restrict it to genre pieces or non-genre pieces. I think I'm right in saying that it was before Blake 7... Watch where they kill off one of the main characters, Toby Wren. He gets blown up by a bomb and he's trying to defuse it.
Before, I think.
Yeah, so that's, you know, it's certainly not unprecedented by any means, but I think it's an interesting question, but I think it might be rendered less interesting, not as your question, Keith, but in terms of what you're trying to say, simply because Gan just wasn't that interesting as a character. No. And I think, as we've alluded to before, and I think
he dies heroically, and you know,
he does, but you almost don't care. I think
that's harsh.
It is.
I have to say, I probably cared more when Zen died.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah,
you care
absolutely.
So much more.
But it did a great thing for the story, because I seem to remember that it really shook the crew.
Yeah, it
up.
Did. It did.
Like, well, and you know, it did help Travis too. You know, at least temporarily, I think, in terms of the audience's eyes of sort of validating that new character, and yeah.
That's it for part one. Join us for part two when we talk cliffhangers, put downs, explore exactly what went wrong with season four, and we give you our picks of the best and worst Blake 7 episodes. Speak to you soon.